Welcome to the Side Hustle Project, a podcast where we explore the nitty-gritty details behind what it takes to start and grow a profitable side hustle. I'm your host, Ryan Robinson, and in this podcast, I'm bringing you interviews with entrepreneurs, best-selling authors, CEOs, investors, and people just like you who are building and profiting from interesting side hustles. In today's episode, we're talking to Lee Mayer, the CEO and co-founder of Havenly, the online interior design and decorating service that's disrupting an industry that had for so long been very old school and traditional. Originally from the Washington, D.C. area, Lee grew up learning much of what she knew about business from her father, who ran multiple successful companies working on government contracts. After attending school at the Columbia School of Business in New York City, Lee went out into the work world, and just a few years into her career, she made the decision to take a slight detour. She applied and got into Harvard Business School, and so she went, and that investment would go on to serve her very well many different ways for the years to come. After working for Bain & Company right out of grad school, Lee decided she was ready for a change of pace, and so she moved out to Denver, Colorado. And it was then, as she was dealing with all the fun that comes along with a cross-country move coupled with wanting her new home to feel like a great space, that Lee and her sister Emily came up with the concept for Havenly. And the rest is history. In this episode, Lee and I talk about the best business advice her father shared with her that is actually still a huge part of who she is today and how she operates Havenly. We dig into the ways she acquired her very first customers at Havenly and how those growth channels have changed throughout the years as the company has grown. We cover her biggest challenges and how she overcame them, her most painful failures, the best investment she's ever made, and more. As always, you can find everything we mentioned in today's episode in the show notes at ryrob.com/podcast. That's spelled ryrob.com/podcast. And one quick note, there are a couple of brief spots where our internet connection was a little bit shaky and led to a few words getting a little distorted. But trust me, it doesn't take anything away from the awesome quality of my conversation with Lee. So without further delay, let's get into today's interview with Lee Mayer. Lee, welcome to the show.
Thanks for having me.
So Lee, I want to start this conversation off by asking the question that I've been asking everyone who comes on the show here. So Lee, what book are you reading right now, or what's been a favorite of yours recently?
So I really love to read fiction. Read a book called Circe, and it's written by someone named Madeline Miller. And for those of you guys that are, you know, classical history or Greek and Roman mythology aficionados, it's really fantastic. It's in fact based on one of the witches from the Odyssey. And it's kind of a subversive retelling of her story. So it's a really fun read and really, really quite good. Beautifully written.
That's really interesting. I'm guessing maybe the Game of Thrones, George R.R. Martin, I believe, Game of Thrones guy, maybe pulled some inspiration for that character there with...
Yeah. The name is similar. It sounds similar. And there are some kind of interesting similarities in the way that she was portrayed in the Odyssey and Cersei Lannister. But I think this retelling is quite entertaining in that a lot of interesting characters that you might remember from your old Greek mythology classes sort of make a little appearance. So it's kind of fun.
Yes, I like it. Okay, so Lee, you, your sister, who you co-founded Havenly with, and the rest of your team at the company are all based in Denver. And I want to just say right off the bat how jealous I am having spent most of the past year there, but I'm back in the Bay Area. So focusing on you, you're not originally from Denver, are you?
I'm not from Denver. I grew up in the DC area, and then I moved to New York when I was about 17 years old, and for the most part spent the rest of my life there. So another 12 years there almost on and off between New York and Boston.
Oh, wow. So that's a recent move for you then.
Yeah. So I've actually been in Denver now for almost 6 years. So 5.5 years, I believe. I mean, time really flies. It was a pretty big move at the time. I can't say I wanted to move to Colorado, but it's been a really, really great couple of years here.
That's really interesting. So what brought you out to Colorado then? Was it a job?
It was just for personal reasons. I think I ended up here not really knowing what to expect. So I am the quintessential East Coast gal. This was before Denver, Colorado was considered a cool place to move to. I mean, now, of course, all of my friends want to move here. I think moved here without a ton of expectations, took a job that I thought was really interesting and exciting. Started to really enjoy it. It took me a couple years to get used to it. People here are just a little bit nicer and a little bit different from what I'm used to.
Weird coming from New York.
I know. I think just rebuilding networks and kind of understanding how people work in Colorado was surprisingly not the most intuitive thing for me coming from the East Coast in New York.
Yeah, I kind of like that. It seems to me that there's sort of a priority on lifestyle over career.
Yeah, I think there is a little bit of that. And for someone like me, it was a little bit more difficult for me to find my tribe while I enjoy having a fantastic life and access to great things. I also, really want to build something cool and do great things with my career. And finding people that were like-minded in that way was actually not the most easy thing when I first moved here. Nowadays, however, I think, frankly, there are tons of people moving here at all sort of different levels of commitment. There are really great, really smart, talented people moving here. But, 5-6 years ago, I don't know that was fully the case.
Well, Lee, so you mentioned that, you grew up in the Washington, D.C. area. So what was it like growing up in that general area? What did your parents do? Take us back in time and tell us about who Lee was growing up.
So the D.C. area is a great area to grow up. I loved it. I had a really wonderful childhood in a lot of ways. So my parents are immigrants to this country. They immigrated. My dad immigrated in the early 70s. My mom immigrated in the late or mid to late 70s. And my dad actually came over and I think originally sort of did, was sort of a busboy and worked as an assistant at a financial services firm. And then ultimately ended up getting his master's and pretty close to finishing a PhD in engineering, at which point he became an engineer for a number of government contracting firms. So the largest of which is Bechtel. He then actually did something interesting and he spun out his own firm. So he started his own government contracting firm and that was the start of his entrepreneurial career. So he was actually a very successful entrepreneur. And one of the interesting things is, the fortunes of my family, as you can imagine, changed dramatically. So from, sort of being of fairly modest means, when I was a young child to going to a very elite private school by the time I graduated from high school. And a lot of that was due to my father's sort of risk and tolerance for risk and willingness to kind of hustle and create a really sort of successful, eventually series of businesses. My mother, on the flip side, actually ended up leaving her job to raise my sister and I full time. So we had her at home while my dad was, kind of working quite a bit to get some of these things off the ground.
Yeah. Well, she definitely had a full-time business of her own.
She did. And she always tells us we don't appreciate her enough. So I am here to say we appreciate you, Mom.
Yes. A lot of props for that. Seriously.
Yeah.
So I'm sensing that you get a lot of your sort of motivation, ambition, maybe call it like risk-taking tendencies from your father. So when you think of advice that he's given you pertaining to business, what kind of jumps up to the surface for you that you'd like to share with our listeners today?
He was always the type of person that gives you incredibly simple advice, which is, by the way, kind of frustrating because, you want him to solve all your problems and then he gives you some advice that's like, of course that's true. And then you try and put it into practice and you realize, yeah, it's true, but it's actually pretty hard to put into practice. So one of his truisms was, do what you say you're going to do, say please and thank you, show up early and leave late. And what's interesting about that is, you know, seems very simple and basic, but it's actually a very, you know, dad, you know, quintessential dad approach to business. And it's, you know, be kind, be polite, you know, execute on what you say you're going to do, and then put in just a little bit more than the next guy. And you'll find yourself being pretty successful. And I think that that's actually proven to be something that I can hold on to quite a bit. There are a lot of twists and turns in starting a business. And I think just this idea that, you know, not everything is incredibly complicated, just execute really well and ignore the noise and you'll be able to figure something out.
I think that advice is also, I mean, it's, first of all, it's profound. It's so simple that anyone can do it, but it's also widely applicable to anyone doing anything, like, right?
That's right. Absolutely. And it's, you know, it's something I actually tell people. It's funny, you know, now I'm in a position where I get to mentor and not just people that work for me, but people in the community or people that work alongside me. And it's funny, I think everyone listens to it and they sort of, you know, snicker maybe a little, but then, you know, you think to yourself, do you show up early and leave late? You know, are you the last person in the office? Do you always say please and thank you? Like, are you always doing what you say you're going to do and when you're going to say, you know, these are actually things that if you do well, you're doing them sort of habitually. And I think it's actually harder than you think.
Yeah, I would agree. I would agree. So Lee, you went to Columbia University in New York City for school, eventually on to Harvard Business School, which are both no small feats. And, you know, to the outside observer like myself, it looks like you made the decision to go to business school after you'd already been out in the workforce a bit, right?
Yeah, that's right. About, I think it was 3 or maybe 4 years in when I went to business school.
What led you to make that decision to sort of, you know, for lack of a better term, put career on hold to go do business school?
You know, that's a really great question. I think, you know, the glib answer is, well, I got in. The less and more thoughtful answer, I think, is a lot around this idea that I felt like I didn't know enough. I just felt, you know, young. I felt like I was smart and I had some, you know, I had a lot of ambition and a lot of sort of drive, but I just felt ill-equipped in some ways to be confident in my opinions or even thoughtful around how I would work through a bit, you know, a business problem. And then, you know, compound that a little bit with, honestly, you know, there's some things about me that I felt a little insecure about. You know, things like even my sort of physical presence, I am very small and I look very young. And so, you know, I just felt like I needed something to kind of prove externally to folks that I was, you know, a capable human. And that combined with this idea that I wanted to know more. So I wanted to know more about how other people have solved business problems, kind of led me to this idea that maybe business school was the place for me. And so, yeah, you know, I applied. I only applied to 2 business schools. I got in, luckily, to both. And, you know, it was great. I loved the experience.
So for those of our listeners here today who are maybe considering business school for themselves, but maybe they're on the fence for some reason or another, would you tell them that it's a worthy investment? And, you know, does that across the board apply to everyone? Or is there a specific sort of use cases where it's better or maybe worse?
I think it really depends. I think typically what I usually say is there are a couple of schools for whom, for the most part, it's a pretty good investment. So, you know, your top 1, 2, or 3 schools, you know, it really does make a pretty big difference in just your access to a really incredible network, as well as access to learning. So I think, you know, there's also probably a large segment of the population that might benefit from going to business school that don't fall into those categories, particularly if you're looking to make either a change in your career. So you're looking to go from one place to another. You're looking to build your network in a local community, and there's a business school that's well known in that local community. So if you think about Boulder, Boulder has Leeds U Boulder Business School, which isn't at sort of the national level, I think, of, say, Stanford or Harvard, but certainly within the community can help provide a ton of connections there. You know, there are people that I, you know, sometimes come to me asking about business school, and I typically tell them, you know, I think you're well past it. You're really far along in your career. What in the world would a business school ever offer you? And so I would really reflect on the fact that you have to not just invest money, but really 2 years of time. And, you know, what could you be doing in the workforce in that 2 years of time? And if it's not, you know, if business school doesn't sort of exceed what you think you can do on your own in those 2 years, it's probably not worth it for you.
That's a great way to evaluate it. I like that a lot. So Lee, fast forwarding up to present day now, you're the CEO and co-founder of Havenly, which is primarily focused on online interior design and decorating services. Can you explain a little bit more in your own words, because I know you'll do a better job, about how the business works today?
Yes. So it is, as you said, the easiest way to decorate your home. So the way it works is we match you up with an interior designer. You actually get to choose from a small selection. We select for you. You pick your favorite, you work with them online, and we basically decorate your home. So it can be from scratch. So you just moved and you've got a blank slate. We also can work with, for example, room refreshes. So your living room looks a little boring and needs a, you know, punch of something, or, you know, your bedroom just lacks a little bit of the oomph. You know, we sort of work with you and your needs. And then you can buy everything you like directly through us at the best price possible. So we actually work across, you know, 500, 400, 500 different vendors, people you might know, like your West Elms of the world, to really unique trade vendors that we have exclusive relationships with. And, you know, it's really a great way to sort of, you know, break through some of the paralysis that kind of can come about when you're trying to do something like decorate your home.
And what I like most about Havenly personally is that you guys took something that was traditionally such an in-person kind of, you know, service offering, right? Like you would traditionally only find an interior designer who lives, you know, maybe somewhere within a 50-mile radius of where you live, right?
That's
right. So what were some of the bigger challenges that you guys faced in translating this kind of business into something that could be totally online for the most part?
You know, I think there are a couple things. There's kind of, if you think about the market that we're targeting, we're actually not targeting people that would traditionally use an interior designer. And so really what we've been trying to do is change behavior. So, you know, effectively we're going to people that would maybe try and do it themselves, or, you know, kind of use a friend, or, you know, I do a lot of things on their own. And we're saying, hey, look, we can help you for a very small fee up front, and it will be materially better than what you can do yourself. And that's challenging. You know, I think trying to convince people that that is, you know, they should change their behavior and sort of create this category. And then also, you know, trying to make sure that they feel like, you know, the fee will be worth it. So translating, you know, sort of this trust factor online, I think, is really was the core of our challenge in the early days, and, you know, still continues to be to some degree for anyone that isn't familiar with us. I think there are also all of the other challenges that go alongside starting a completely new company. So first of all, I had no idea what I was doing. So that's a big challenge. I think, you know, starting something from scratch, I don't want to diminish that experience. I mean, it's almost like magic. And, you know, you're literally one day, you know, 4 years ago, nothing existed. And now, you know, we employ and pay hundreds of people. And that's pretty amazing. And so I think trying to just figure the overwhelming nature of trying to figure out what to do is a pretty daunting thing.
Yeah, I would agree. And, you know, you mentioned the early days, so I want to take a quick step back there. Yeah. I know you co-founded the company with your sister, Emily. How did you two come up with the inspiration for this business? Was this kind of an idea that came randomly, or was it like a problem solution?
So I think for us, it was very much a problem solution. So we personally were feeling... we're feeling the pain ourselves. So I had moved from my, you know, incredibly tiny one bedroom apartment in New York to Denver, Colorado, where all of a sudden I had a four bedroom house. And, you know, I was working
for the same price.
Yeah, exactly. Maybe less, but, but I was working all the time. I was working, you know, 80 hour weeks, and, I remember not feeling equipped to make these decisions, but I bought this house and I wanted to feel like an adult. And my sister Emily, you know, was ultimately going through a very similar experience. In this case, she was moving to New York. And she was sort of like, what is, this is crazy. Like, all I want is, you know, a pretty house. And, you know, I was saying the same thing. And, you know, somehow while we were talking, you know, I was like, you know, what if we figured out a way to match underutilized interior designers, so interior designers that were unable to get sort of senior level work, but were really talented, with consumers that needed help. And that's kind of how it came about. It was really just a personal, gosh, I really want this, that kind of translated itself into a larger business.
Those seem to be the ideas that really stick the most and resonate with other people too, when you've kind of brought them to life out of a problem you have personally.
Yeah, it's, I mean, I think it's helpful. I think, you know, the challenge then is to translate what can be a very unique problem into something that everyone relates to. So, you know, it turns out not everyone works 8 hours a week, and maybe they do want to get more involved in their design. And so how do you create a product that speaks to them and provides value for them just as much as it would have for me at that time?
Do you remember the first paying customer you guys had at Havenly that, I'm going to add the caveat, that wasn't a close friend or family member?
Yeah, we definitely started off with close friends or family members, but I actually remember the first customer that we had that wasn't a friend or a family member. And that's actually, you know, probably a bigger, kind of a, was a bigger deal for me for a lot of reasons. It was a woman out of New Jersey, and she was getting married, and it was just super exciting when she used us. And she's actually been a client with us for years. So we've now done 2 different homes, 6 different rooms for her.
Oh my gosh, that's awesome. Do you remember how she found you guys out? Was it like word of mouth or online?
Yeah. So all of our first clients, for the most part, were word of mouth.
I like that. So over the past, you know, 5 years, of you guys, you guys have grown up a lot, the company. So what has changed as far as how you are getting new customers today?
So I think, you know, one of the things that changes is you start to experiment with paid advertisements. So that can mean everything from traditional advertisements, so that's TV, radio, billboards, to more typically in a business that is tech-enabled, digital advertisements. So those are on Google or Facebook or Pinterest or Instagram. And, you know, I think for us, we've experimented a lot with those things, with those formats. You know, one of the things that I always like to say is it's actually typically pretty expensive to acquire a new customer. And if you aren't able to deliver a product that has some word of mouth virality to it, it's going to be very difficult to economically acquire customers. And that is something that we like to go back to all the time. And that's this idea that really this has to have some word of mouth component to it. And in order to do that, it has to be an interesting product that provides real value to people. And so we're constantly kind of trying to figure out how to do that, and how to build that for folks.
I agree completely with you. I think that's, you know, when you have something that people want to share with their friends, their family, and they just shout it from the mountaintops about you, that's, I mean, that's essentially free customer acquisition.
It really is. And I think for this particular category, it's just so important. And, you know, we don't always get it right. But I think when we get it wrong, we own up to it and we try and make it right. And we try our best to make sure that the vast majority of people that use us leave with an incredibly positive experience. And, you know, that's really, we have a fairly large team here, and that's really, we only have a few people on the marketing side. The bulk of the team here is really focused on delivering value for the customer.
I like it. Well, Lee, we're getting close to the end of our interview here. So I want to ask you a couple of my quick questions that I've designed to be short on my end. Your answers do not need to be equally so.
Okay.
Do you have any particular strategies, tactics, or ideas that you guys have tested at Havenly that come to mind in particular as having been a failure at the end of the day?
Yeah, I mean, there's so many that it's almost hard to choose from. I think a couple of things. So, you know, when we first started out, a lot of consumer companies were raising these like enormous rounds of capital, and they were, to our earlier point, spending a lot of money on digital advertising. And the idea was you should scale quickly, burn a lot of money, become a huge company, land grab. You know, it was very like sort of bullish market mindset. And I think ultimately, it just doesn't go well. Like, so first of all, when you scale beyond your capabilities, you get unhappy customers. Second, it can be so expensive that it starts to not make any sense. So we had this, we brought on this like kind of fancy CMO who had worked at, he was a really nice guy, but had worked at a pretty big company. And thus we were spending these huge budgets. And it just doesn't work. I mean, not every company is able to throw, $20 million in marketing in a year and get a really great return. And so that was a really good learning lesson for me, that you can't be, in order to sort of really build a sustainable business, you have to be really thoughtful about where you're spending your money.
That is awesome advice. Well, Lee, this is going to be my last question for you.
Okay.
What's been the best investment you feel you've ever made in the context of growing your business? And this could be in the form of time, money, tools, products, services, people, or otherwise.
I think, the best investment have been a few of the people that we've brought in. We have some really stellar folks on the team. And I think, a really great investment in people, and when you feel like it's a really great investment in that person, you're getting so much more out of them. I mean, I have some people on the team that are so capable of running, the piece of the business that they run, that I don't even have to think about it. I mean, I'm there as a sounding board, and I'm certainly there to like sort of help direct or just bounce ideas off of. But ultimately, it means that there's, entire chunks of the business that someone else is handling, and handling super well, better than I could. And I think that's really where you get incredible leverage as a leader, is finding someone who can handle components of the business way better than you can, so you can sort of focus your time on the things that you're really great at and that you have to do.
Yes. I love it, Lee. That is priceless. Thank you again for coming onto the show. Can you tell everyone listening where they can go to learn more about you, Havenly, and everything that you guys are up to?
Yeah, absolutely. So you can go to www.havenly.com and learn a lot more about us. And you can follow me on Instagram at Lee at Havenly.
Beautiful. All right. Well, Lee, thank you again for joining us.
Thanks again. Have a really great afternoon.
If you enjoyed this episode of The Side Hustle Project, I would love your support. Head on over to the Apple Podcasts app and give us a rating. And as always, you can catch every episode of The Side Hustle Project on Apple Podcasts, Stitcher, and wherever you get your podcasts. Thanks for tuning in.